lot of people fantasize about living the kind of life you're living. For people who just have fantasies of a more stereotypically adventurous, active life, almost as an escape valve, do you think they would actually be happy doing it? And secondly, have you met people doing what you do who have taken that leap and then realized that it's not really what they want because they were only looking at the fantasy part of it and not the big picture?
I haven't met many people who gave up steady work, like a steady job that was a good job, that paid well, to fly in Alaska or to be a guide. I don't know if I've met any, in all honesty. I'm trying to say, my friend Paul, who I guide with, you could say that, you know, he was in the Army for 8 years, and then he was a paramedic, was looking at going to PA school, and possibly he'd be an example of kind of dropped all that, but he wasn't really doing, if he'd become a PA and dropped it, I think that would be valid, but he never became a PA. He realized early on and moved on. Now, do I think people would like it when they fantasize about it and think it'd be great? I doubt it. Most of these jobs are not what the perception of them is. Again, we talk about this a fair amount, but like flying and being a bush pilot in Alaska, in quotes, it's really a blue-collar job. It's a hard blue-collar job. Certainly in the version I like it, it's more that way. I mean, there are some jobs up there that people would like to call being a bush pilot, where they wear uniforms and people load the bags on the plane for them. And they're just an airline pilot. They're not a bush pilot. So I don't think most people would like it. I mean, generally you're living in pilot housing with a lot of other people. If you're older, you're usually living with a lot younger people. Usually they're partying. So it'd be kind of loud in the house, usually not that clean. There's a lot of time where you're not doing stuff. You know, those really good moments are rare. There's a lot of just getting through the week or getting through the day. Now I think that doing that, getting those few moments, is worth it. But that's one reason I stopped flying so much. Those moments becoming fewer and further between, because you've had so many moments like this. It's not like a new special moment. It's like, oh yeah, this is what happens at this time. I mean, Northern Lights are always cool, but it can be if you're shooting an ILS down to minimums and you see the runway, instead of like, whew, there's the runway, you're just like, oh well, of course the runway's there, because I just shot the ILS. That's what's at the end of an ILS. So it's not exciting.
An ILS is an instrument landing system, which is a way of flying to a runway in the clouds, basically.
Did that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. Have there been times when you've thought about changing the path you're on, or is the path all along, it's been so zigzaggy and unknown that there's no
there
such
is
thing
no
as
path.
There is no change because there is no path.
that's it right there.
Sounds like something Yoda would say.
Yeah, there is, that's exactly it. There is no change. There's no real path. Certainly the last couple of years with climbing and guiding, I've just been jumping at opportunities. I'm trying to change that a little bit because it's not leading to my best climbs. I'm leading some good ones, but not ones that I've necessarily thought of or really, really wanted to do. But they were just, the opportunity was there, so you do them. There's no real path. You know, you get the calls at 10 at night when I'm sitting in my truck in Bishop. Damn it, Mike. I'm still in my truck. What am I supposed to do next week?
Yeah, but I also get the calls from the top of a mountain in China.
Yeah.
On a satellite phone.
Yeah, those can be nice. I mean, that's where it's all, I mean, this spring was particularly, seemed like there was a lot of extra downtime. I don't need that much downtime again. But, that's those moments, you know, climbing a mountain in China, it's worth it.
Yep.
You know, that makes it worthwhile. But I think it's just the same. You know, my friend Doug in Virginia was a family, and you know, he certainly likes his family more than anything out there. But there are plenty of frustrating moments having kids, especially young kids. Mm-hmm. And you tend to hear about the frustrating moments, but at the same time, when they show up in Seattle, he's super happy, just psyched to see them. You know, that's what it's about for him. Mm-hmm. So despite the fact that there are frustrations involved, they're great moments. Mm-hmm. Climbing's the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's climbing or flying. You know, there are large periods of time where it's not great. It's spiked by these really good moments.
Mm-hmm.
At the advantage of kids, might eventually pay your dental bill or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or the mountains will never do,
right.
Never do that for you.
Right. So moving around so much, speaking of family and kids and relationships and stuff, like, is it, you know, I kind of know the answer, but for the sake of everyone who isn't me, you know, is it even possible to have a real relationship that is with anybody who's not in the same place mentally and physically in their lives, moving around so much?
Not really.
Yeah.
I mean, they're conceivably, yes. I mean, mm-hmm. But if you've got a partner, it's either going to help them be very stable and live in one place, and that's where you always return to.
Mm-hmm.
And you return there at fairly frequent intervals.
Right.
Like, you can't be gone for 6 months,
right.
Home for 10, gone
you
for 6 months.
You mean like a friend whose couch you sleep on periodically?
Yeah. That
I
works
see.
Really well.
I see.
gives me a mailing address.
Right.
But, I mean, there are some couples that can make that work,
right.
in a situation like that. And then when your downtime that I have, when I'm in my truck in the Southwest, you have it where you're home. You're doing projects around the house. Alex Lowe, you know, famous climber, is a great example of that. He had, like 4 kids and a wife who stayed home, and he was gone a fair amount. But by and large, I think it's impractical to think that you're going to have a relationship that really works with someone who's not living your type of life,
mm-hmm.
If you are going to keep living that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing if you can slow down and do a trip to China every year and a trip to Alaska, so there's
right.
2 or 3 months where you're gone a year, but the rest of the time you're pretty much home. You know, that's not, that wouldn't be a problem. So I guess I'm answering, yeah, for my specific instance where I move around more than most people,
right.
even guides that I know, you know, yeah, it won't work.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I find someone willing to
right.
traipse a little bit.
What would you say for you, not objectively speaking, but from your perspective, what's the hardest part of the kind of life you lead?
I don't know. I was thinking about this today. Something popped up. I forgot what it was. And this may not be the hardest thing, but because I just tend to ignore things that just don't work. I just ignore it. But society's not developed to deal with people who don't live in one place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard just to take care of basic stuff,
mm.
like taps for my truck.
Mm-hmm.
It's happened the last couple of years I've been here, and this time of year, which is great. I can go take care of it. But it wouldn't be inconceivable that my truck would be down in the Southwest. And it's small things like that, just where
mm-hmm.
you know, someone wants a mailing address,
mm-hmm.
and you can't give them one.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get a credit card, let's say, because you don't have a mailing address. And you'll get response from people like, well, you have to have an address where you live. And, you know, it's clearly I'm not homeless, or I mean, I am homeless, actually,
right.
but I'm not destitute,
right.
I guess is the way to put it. And so people are just like, well, you have to live somewhere. I'm like, no, I really don't live in any one place.
Mm-hmm.
And then I give your address in the end. but yeah, so I think that American, U.S. society, and probably many other countries, is just not really designed to work well with someone who wants a lifestyle like this.
What are some of the goals that you still have outstanding? Because, you know, clearly you're not just climbing and flying and taking whatever comes along just because you love climbing and flying and it's fun and whatever you end up doing will be great. You seem very mission-oriented and that there are specific kinds of things you would like to do. So what are some of those?
Oh, yeah. It's a huge list.
Mm.
I mean, it's huge. I mean, I can get more specific and say that there's some traverses I want to do in the Sierra. I've got some climbing left in China I want to do. I'd love to fly fire bombers or fire suppression at some point. It'd be cool to get a helicopter license. I'd like to fly in Antarctica. Those are kind of the flying ones. The list is always big, you always fantasize.
Right.
I'd love to go to Mars. Why not?
Right. There's movies like the one I haven't seen called The Bucket List with Jack Nicholson.
Right.
You know, where it's, you know, people have their list of things they fantasize about doing in their lives, and that's sort of separate from their everyday life. It seems like for you, your whole life is about that list.
Yeah, that might be right. I mean, and yeah, I guess a more achievable long-range fantasy that sail around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I've been talking about that for a few years. That's probably 10 years off, but,
mm-hmm.
well, 10 years before I get the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do the trip when I'm 70.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you probably heard me tell this story. The captain I flew with it when I was flying the fuel around Alaska, we were laughing and joking because I'd look down at a river and say, God, I really want to swim that river. Which often would be pretty silly to try to swim some of those rivers. And he said, you know what I should do? I should just take out a $1 million life insurance policy on you, and we make a list of 10 things that you have to do in the next year.
Uh-huh.
And then I will just fund those events, and you have to accomplish all of them. And then if you survive, well, you got a free year of doing all the things you want to do. And if you don't survive, he gets the $1 million policy. You know, and it had things like, you know, swimming with great white sharks. Just a bizarre
right.
list. But so you can make an actual
mm-hmm.
list.
Mm-hmm.
But the list of like climbing objectives is huge. And
mm-hmm.
There's lots of cool flying jobs I still would like to do. Unfortunately, I know enough about flying now that I know what the reality of most of those jobs is,
mm-hmm.
which isn't usually nearly as exciting as
mm-hmm.
it looks. Whereas climbing is as exciting as you want to make it, unless you're guiding. Guiding's different. You're at someone else's, working with other people. But when it's your own climb, you always choose the most challenging climb you can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the point. Then you decide when it's too risky. Or we always joke, you always choose the hardest climb, and then you really hope when you get to it,
mm-hmm.
that's a lot easier than you thought it might be.
Mm-hmm.
Because really hard stuff sounds really good when you're sitting in a coffee shop looking at maps and whatnot, but when you're actually in the spot and you're faced with some hard moves or days or whatever's going on,
mm-hmm.
usually you would rather be easier than
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
That's what we always joke about that.
Mm-hmm. Did you get lonely ever? Either within these specific activities you're doing, you know, you talked earlier about being in China by yourself on a climb for 25 days in a tent.
No, I don't get lonely.
No?
Yeah, my pop asked me that.
Yeah.
And people assume you'd be lonely because you're by yourself a lot. But it's not, I actually heard something on NPR that talked about loneliness, and the expert person was, you know, the interviewer said the same thing. You know, loneliness, if people are alone, it must be lonely. He said, no, that's not the case at all. As long as you feel you have connections to people,
mm-hmm.
You probably don't get lonely.
Okay, connections meaning not technological connections in that moment, but knowing that there are people out there who care about you and who you interact with when you can.
Yeah, I call you all the time.
Yeah.
Or I call my sister up. She's not home very often, but you know, there are people I talk to on a fairly regular basis.
Yeah.
If I figure out the computer, I might email more often.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if I didn't talk to you for 6 months or a year, or to Doug in Virginia or my sister,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's certainly a group of people that I talk to fairly regularly, and if I didn't talk to them for a long period of time,
mm-hmm.
I would probably get lonely.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason that would. I mean, if I was thrown in a prison,
right? I've heard you say you were born in the wrong century. Do you think? You know, obviously, if you were born 200 or 300 years ago, you wouldn't be flying, but there would be other things you were doing that you'd find equally interesting. Given that this type of, you know, adventurous activity back then, it took longer to get to the site of the adventure, or the adventure was longer. You know, people would go on expeditions that took 6 months or a year with no satellite phones and no way of sending emails or communicating at all? Do you think, it's a weird question, I guess, because, you know, it's one thing to say you as a modern person go back then, would you feel lonely? Well, maybe, but if you were back then...
You're in a totally, your whole perception of what you're supposed to be experiencing is different, so I think it's hard to answer that.
Yeah.
And I suspect that a lot of those, I mean, think about it, a lot of those trips you're doing with hundreds of people.
Right.
Because that's how you had to do them. And rarely was it just you going out, like Marco Polo.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like he went all by himself, or Columbus didn't come to the U.S. by himself on, you know, there's a lot of people on the, on the ship.
That's a very good point.
and your perception's different. You know, I'd like to go back to certain periods, like aviation, the beginning of aviation would have been really, I think it'd be great to be involved with the early mail flights and pioneering the Andes. I mean, that would have been just a cool period of time. I think those type of moments still exist. You just have to find them.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect back in those days it was the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Because your normal standard channel that society kind of put you into didn't take you in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to step outside the stream, the mainstream, and say, I want to try that.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't always recognize something as a groundbreaking event or activity until after it's becomes mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
Rock climbing, you know, in the 70s and 80s, well, I think you can go back further, but in the 70s and 80s in the U.S., rock climbing was still pretty new and way out there. And actually, even in the 90s, when I first started it, I didn't view it that way. But in light of where it is now, with climbing gyms everywhere and half the population seems like they, you know, are rock climbers.
Right.
So there's still activities that you can get in on the ground floor that are going to become big if that's what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think you need to do activities for the activity's sake.
Taking this path that's not a path for the last, 16 years since we met?
Yeah.
Are there things you've learned or ways in which you've grown personally other than just skill acquisition that you weren't necessarily expecting? Right? Or just things
no,
that...
No, I had no expectations about where I would... I still don't really about where I'm going to go or where I'm going to end up.
Yeah.
Things can always go one way or the other. And I mean, I can always see multiple branches in the trail, and as you get closer, you end up going on down one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But usually you know, it's not always planned out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I've changed over the years. I just, you know, when it happens to you, you don't really see it.
Right.
So,
among the people you encounter along the path that's not a path, do you feel like you're one of them or that you're an anomaly?
You're pretty much one of them. That's sort of, like I said earlier, when you're doing this, everybody's kind of doing it.
Right.
So you're certainly one of them.
But do you think about it all in the same way that, you know, most pilots do, most climbers do?
Not completely. Partly because the climbing and flying are fairly separate types of people.
Right.
And I sort of have a foot in both camps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a slight difference. So, like a lot of climbing guides, it's hard to find climbing guiding work sometimes, so they have issues with just struggling to find work. And I just step back and say, oh, I'm just going to go, guys, I'm going flying for a couple months. I'm going to make a lot more money.
A lot more money?
Yeah, I'll be back in a few months,
and
they're ski patrolling, making a quarter of what I'm making. So I sort of have that, a little financial security over what some of my guiding friends might have. And the pilots are, it's a different, you know, flying wise, we certainly relate, but most of them don't climb much.
Right.
Not across the board, but that's not usually, so they don't quite, Not that they don't get it, but they're just not that interested in it, if that fits.
Yeah, that makes sense. Question. Given all this, what advice would you give somebody who's contemplating taking a more adventurous approach to their own life? Not necessarily meaning they want to have the same kind of physical adventures that you have, but...
Well, the key is to identify, either you put this one or two ways, either identify what you really want to do or what makes you really happy.
Mm-hmm.
And you could probably approach it either way. If you can identify what makes you happy, find a way to make that the primary focus of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you don't have to do other things to make a living or whatnot, but whatever makes you happy should be what you spend the majority of your time either doing or thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
That fits with what you want to do. With what you want to do, I think, is a little more list-oriented. Like, there are these events or these jobs or these things I want to do, and that may be what makes you happy, is doing these things, which may not be climbing. It may be you want to be a pilot, and that may be something you want to do, or you may want to go skydiving, or I mean, it doesn't even have to be anything.
Or maybe watching certain movies. Or
completely, yeah. Like, your goal is you want to become a movie critic. Or, you know, and again, it doesn't have to be a job. Mm-hmm. But I think the key there, though, is to identify what you want to do or what makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
And the two are probably pretty much the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different approach to getting there.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be a family and a steady 9-to-5 job, but you know, a job that most people would say, well, that's not an exciting job.
Mm-hmm.
But who cares if it's allowing you to do these other things that make you happy?
Right. When you started doing this, it started with flying way back before I met you. Was that a leap into a different kind of life? Like, were you on one path and then you decided, oh, I'm going to go do something else? Or is this just an extension of what you've always...
Well, that was a need to find a career.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we've always talked about our alternate starts there, where I almost went to college and you almost joined the Marine Corps. So I joined the Marine Corps, and prior to that, I'd been doing triathlons and struggling to pay bills and just live while training all the time. That involved, like, with dishwashing, the job I always bring up. And when I got out of the Marine Corps, I was a baker at the same place I used to wash dishes. But what I decided at that point was I did not want to go back and be a dishwasher again. I wanted to acquire some sort of skill that would give me a job that I enjoyed doing, and that would keep me from washing dishes again. And after a year of hanging out and drinking a lot, I decided that flying would be it. I wanted to fly since I was little, so it's like, well, it's good. And if I hadn't liked it, I would have just tried something else. You know, I would have done it for 2 years and said, nah, I need to go back and be a stockbroker.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just identifying what makes you happy or what you want to do. And at that point, what I wanted to do was fly.
Yeah. And I remember you've always told me that, you know, at some point, if you do something long enough, no matter what the job, it's work.
Yeah.
And that this fantasy that people have of, you know, unless you're wealthy enough to just go on your own personal climbing projects and fly your own plane wherever you want, whenever you want, you have to work, and you might as well have a job and a career that you like, but it's still work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And flying Alaska is definitely work. There are a lot of downsides to it. And I suspect for anybody it's work, but you have to find something that is challenging, or you know, it just depends what everybody's view of challenge is different.
Yeah.
Like I said, my sister loves her work, but it's still work.
Yeah.
But she really enjoys it, enjoys what she does with it.
Yeah.
You enjoyed working on Flight Sim at Microsoft.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you would have left years and years ago.
Yeah.
Because it was fun, used a lot of skills. And So everything becomes work, but you still have to do it.
Yeah. Well, and one thing I admire about you and your approach toward all this is that you don't have an attitude about it. You know, I remember one of our favorite movies from a long time ago.
Oh, really?
was Point Break.
Oh yeah.
Where Patrick Swayze's character leading the weird gang of
you know, bank robber surfers,
tattooed bank robber surfers. They really had this attitude that, you know, they're living this adventurous life and everybody else is living in their little boxes and driving to work on the freeway all day, and your life sucks and I'm so cool and you should be like me.
Well, and I've run into people like that who they seem to feel like they shouldn't, they're not working, they're barely making a living. And this is the minority. And I ran to a guy to climb gear, and he had just kind of acknowledged that he might have acquired some climbing gear that was not his, and I was giving him shit about it because I just think that's wrong. And he, one of his comments was, well, you know, they make a lot more money than I do, so they can afford to go get more gear. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, that's absolutely insane. You're saying now, because you think you're so cool, mm-hmm. everybody should be supporting your cool lifestyle. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not right. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody does their own thing. And you just have to be happy with what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And not that I'm always happy with, I mean, you're going to have ups and downs. Mm-hmm. But you have to keep track of, if you're in a down, you need to change something. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just sit in a down or thing where you're not happy and just wait for something to miraculously occur to make your life better. Mm-hmm. You got to be proactive.
So it takes more than positive thinking.
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess one analogy I haven't thrown in here yet that I always like to use that is a good guideline for certainly how I want to live my life. When I'm 70 or 80 and not as mobile, maybe, I want to be able to look back and say that I tried everything I wanted to try. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it goes sort of like that no regrets sort of comment, but a little bit different than that, because it, you should never have any real regrets about how you live your life, but the idea that there, if something's interesting and exciting to you, you should look into it at least. You don't actually have to do it, but you should at least do some research and see if it's worth doing or possible to do. Sometimes things aren't possible, mm-hmm. and then you just say, okay, well, that's really cool, but I'm never going to have a 120-foot motor yacht that I go scuba diving in the Caribbean with. Yeah. You know, it's just not going
to.
You know,
yeah. But you can learn to scuba dive on a single trip. And go on a motor yacht.
Yeah, usually do some version of it. Yeah. You know, if I had a family now and I just discovered climbing, instead of saying, wow, okay, well, I'm never going to be a great climber, so I'm just not going to do it, you can say, well, this is interesting. Let me go spend the next month on, you know, one weekend day a month, I'm going to go climbing and see if I do like it. And if you don't like it, you're like, well, didn't like that. Yeah. But at least you tried it.
Do you find when you're taking clients climbing, you know, I think your role, sometimes it's a role of an instructor and other times it's a guide, but do you find, are people ever envious of your life, or do they view it as, you know, you have these skills because you do it all the time and you're helping them accomplish their goals on this vacation, but then they're happy to go home having done that?
That's usually the case. Most people are happy. They really have a great time doing the climb. I mean, some don't have a great time, but usually people really, I think, enjoy it. But I'd say most of them are happy to go back to their life. The exception might be if we get younger clients who are in their 20s, and they're usually looking at getting into climbing more, maybe becoming a guide. And so they tend to more look up to the guiding job and say, but that's really cool. If you get your more average client, might be a someone in their mid-40s to mid-50s, probably a professional, maybe not a doctor or lawyer, but probably some sort of professional job. And they usually think it's cool, and they say, wow, that's a really cool life. But they're, I think, quite happy to go back to usually their families. And because again, that's what makes them happy. They like having these little adventures, but they don't want to live in their truck. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'd be miserable. And they know it. I mean, living in your truck's not that great. Mm-hmm. It has good moments, but by and large, it's not that great.
Which is why it's important to have friends with couches.
Exactly, yeah. And it's, it's a means to an end.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and I'll point out that it's also good, if you have a couch, to have a friend who's living a very interesting life to sleep on it occasionally so that you can vicariously live through that friend.
Right, thereby negating the need for you to go out and actually be
exactly.
miserable.
Exactly.
Well, that's like when you came to visit in Alaska. Because you'd always talk about flying in Alaska, and you finally came to Nome that one time.
Yeah, that was eye-opening.
What was it, by the third day? It's like, so, you want to go to Unalakleet with me today?
No.
I think that's okay. I've seen enough of it.
I flew up to Alaska commercially to go flying with Aiden, and it was totally overcast and pouring rain the entire time. This was in the fall, I think. And we were out in Nome flying over the Bering Sea to all these little villages. And I spent a day or two flying around with him. And I realized it kind of ties into what you said earlier, that, you know, all the romantic notions that I had about what this was going to be just vanished.
Yeah.
And I remember the exact moment it happened. We were taking off out of St. Michael's. I think
is that
what it's called.
St. Mike's and Stebbins.
And we climbed up through the clouds, and we're sitting, we're flying along on top of the clouds, and the sun's shining in, and it's beautiful. And I had the thought, like, this is the life. I'm living the life of an Alaskan bush pilot. This is so cool. And in the back of the plane was a generator that we had loaded on these guys and a snow machine and all this stuff. And it was really, you know, blue collar and cool, and I was thinking, this is it, this is what I want to do. And then you tuned in airplanes, there's a radio called an ADF, for automatic direction finder, and the frequency range for it happens to be there's some crossover with the AM radio broadcast frequencies,
so we got 780 KNOM. KNOM.
And you tuned it in, and all of a sudden, as I'm having these thoughts about I'm a bush pilot, I'm kind of feeling like, you know, I'm back 50 years ago doing this. All of a sudden, I heard click and clack from Car Talk on NPR blasting into my headphones. And I realized, this is what you do.
Like, that's the best part of the week, is click and clack on the weekend.
And it was like somebody just burst the bubble. And I realized, you know what? My fantasy is not reality. And yet then I did, over time, come to see that
click and clack are great.
That there are other aspects of it that are equally cool. And I think the lesson there is, and it kind of ties into stuff you've said during this conversation, that a lot of times the disappointment, or really you can only be disappointed by the reality if you have a fantasy.
Right.
And it sounds like your sort of lack of, you know, a really well-defined path. You have goals, but you don't have expectations in terms of what those experiences will be like. And I think doing that, it makes you more present and more able to pay attention to the amazing things that are actually happening, as opposed to always comparing them against what you thought was going to happen.
That's someone to accept that, as you know too, I never live in the present. I'm always 3 months ahead. Mm-hmm. I know, because people always say, wow, you must live in the present all the time, be like really focused on the present. I never am. I'm on one climbing trip, I'm thinking of the next one.
Now what is that about? Is that because you're excited about the next one?
Yeah, I mean, it's like something to look forward to. It's just the way I work. I don't spend a lot of time looking back. Like, a lot of people talk about their past trips. Your trip to Nome is an example too. If you tried it, now you're not really going to not regret, but you're never going to think, boy, I should have gone and flown in Alaska, because now you saw what it's about, which is the key to looking back and saying, boy, I tried everything I thought I should.